If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The front three, which this week is the front two. Kristen Hennig joins me as well, obviously joining me all the way from near Newcastle this weekend. A relatively good result for those guys, Chris.
Yes, it wasn't terrible. Draw is a point. It's better than none, I guess.
Okay, no, but I guess when you're the aim this season really is 40, isn't it? That's still a point closer to 40.
It is. I think there's a bit of discourse at the minute whether it's actually even going to take 40. There's some speculation that it could be anywhere from 37 to 40 being that magic target. I'm not so sure.
In which case, you guys are 17 points off those 40 points.
Yeah, which, given the amount of games left, you would sort of hope your team could accrue that many. We'd almost even argue, if you were perhaps being a bit pessimistic, if you can't get 17, then, yeah, you definitely don't deserve to be in the league.
Yeah, I mean, looking at Newcastle's run over the next few weeks, there's definitely some games in there that are going to challenge them. Obviously, next up, Man City versus Newcastle. They then got Burnley, Palace, Manchester United, and Liverpool, all within the next six games. So it's not an easy run for Rafa over these next few weeks.
No, it's not. But I think in a bizarre turn of fate, without wishing to condemn them to a number of losses, they appear to have done better in the games where the impetus hasn't necessarily been on them to drive the game. I think if you look at, say, the Swansea away game, Stoke away more recently, actually even West Ham as well, there's been instances there where the home team have been expected to push on, to drive forward and dictate things, and that's kind of where Newcastle have been able to exploit the space in behind, whereas home games to Swansea, Brighton, where Newcastle have had to come out, hasn't really suited them.
Yeah, and that's also been slightly limited by personnel, right? In the fact that you guys don't have any personnel. And the other day, Rafa even sort of publicly said, we don't even know how much the transfer budget for this month is.
Yeah, that's a huge hindrance, is not even knowing what you can spend, because, well, I think it's obvious what issues that presents itself. I think in essence the squad is lacking just that little bit of, not so much diversity, but a plan B or someone with something a bit different. It's very much set up in my mind to play one way, and I think really what Rafa did was sign some key players like Dwight Gale and Matt Ritchie for big money, and then try to shop smartly in other avenues with guys like Moreno and Isaac Hayden. I mean, those two cost less than 10 million. I think he's perhaps a little bit looking for something different. But at the same time, I think a lot of the issues that he would want to address are issues that he marked in the summer. He wanted a better goalkeeper. And if you look, maybe not recently, but you point to the home game at Everton where Darlow makes a bit of a cock-up that ultimately gives Everton the winning goal. And a game that, to be very honest, Everton didn't threaten, I would say, for large periods. There's only one chance they had other than that I can think of. That's one issue that he wanted to address. He wanted a new left-back. Excuse me. a number 10 with some real craft, and he went hard for Dennis Pratt, who now is being linked to Juventus and was a player that Newcastle could have had. There was a deal lined up for him. There was even talk that he wanted a new striker, that for him, he'd already sanctioned Dwight Gayle to move to, I think it was Fulham and Wolves were circling. So I think a lot of what he outlined they needed to do with this January coming, yes, they're by no means down, but it's certainly a risk, I would say, heading into February if there's no additions. A lot of what he outlined for them to do in the summer now looks like being, I would say, almost proved or affirmed by the first half of the season.
Yeah, in many ways, those 23 points are an achievement to this point. Although some other people, it does seem a little like some other people are making other teams that are underachieving massively look better. I guess that's part of it at Newcastle at the moment, isn't it, Chris? That you, as I mean, obviously as a Newcastle fan and someone who covers them, you are seeing a bit of a conflict because Mike Ashley hasn't done what he needs to do to keep a club in the Premier League. But all the fans and Rafa and some other personnel very much feel like they are trying to keep the club in the Premier League and trying to achieve something.
Yeah, I think for me, that is the ultimate conflict here, is that ultimately the squad that you're watching, it's so different to the one that was last in the Premier League, because that squad had talent. It had Wijnaldum, Sissoko, Mitrovic. There was players in there that I think on their day could produce that match-winning quality, and did to get them to the points total that they eventually ended on. The problem was that it had no fight, it had no character, it had no togetherness. And I think, honestly, had Benitez come in January of that season, they probably would have scraped up. And I think you compare that to this current generation, they are a very together unit. They work hard for each other. They're industrious. They run often more than their opponents do, but they don't necessarily have that match-winning quality. You're relying on the likes of Hosolu, the likes of Shelvey, to do something a little bit above kind of what they're used to. And I think that's the great issue here, is that when you look at that contingent group of players, or you look at that little set of players, they're all kind of known for having a moment of quality in them, but no consistency. And the problem is that the stars don't align enough for them at the minute to win games, I would say, on a consistent basis.
Yeah, I mean, let's see how the Rafa system develops. I'm studying that at the moment. It's rather an interesting system that you could say Rafa has been quite pragmatic with over the last few years, and learned as he's gone from club to club to work with the resources that he has. Then people know what a fan of Rafa I am on this podcast. Maybe I'm just being hyperbolic. It doesn't feel that way, though. Interestingly, elsewhere, just below Newcastle, we're seeing a lot of results which do seem to make Newcastle look a lot better, considering where they're struggling with right now. Stoke City obviously lost 3-0 to Manchester United tonight, Chris. Lukaku capped off, you'd say, or sort of completed a good win for United with a 3-0 victory, and ultimately some goals for the guys who need them at the moment, Martial and Lukaku.
Yeah, he seemed to have a bit of a frustrating evening at times. I don't think he was too pleased with the treatment he received from some of the Stoke back line, most notably Bruno Martins-Indy. And I think, look, you have to kind of be physical with Lukaku, otherwise he will bully you. I thought his goal was well taken overall. I thought Manchester United played well in patches. The thing I noticed with them is there's never like a total dominance of a game. It's not, it never feels like you were throttled necessarily. In fact, I wondered if I did wonder if there's part of them that almost invites their opposition on, because it makes the game easier for them. Because it opens up those spaces, it allows them to counterattack. Whereas when they're trying to break someone down, and I noticed this more in the second half when Stoke sort of put the shutters down and accepted they were going to lose, it seemed much harder for Man United to get in behind to cause real problems. Whereas in the first half, where things were a little bit more open, it definitely seemed to suit them more, and I think created better chances for them overall.
It certainly was interesting to watch United tonight, especially against this Stoke team, who will less than likely be revitalised by a new manager. Chris, what do you think of the appointment of... What's his name again?
Paul Lambert.
Paul Lambert. I was going to say Paul Jewell. I thought that was even worse. But yeah, Paul Lambert. Fair pick TV. Seemed less than excited, as you might assume, especially considering the names that were up there before. Kike Sanchez-Flores, Martin O'Neill, Roy Keane. This does now look a little underwhelming.
I can understand why. The thing with managerial appointments is your mind, I think, if you're a supreme optimist, your mind will try and take the entire resume in.
Right.
And so you'll look at what he did with Norwich, which was back-to-back promotions after, I think they beat his Colchester side 7-1, and then he was hired not long after. Villa, he did, I think, a fairly stable job. The concerning thing is that thereafter, it doesn't make for pleasant reading. With Paul Lambert. He has obviously a very impressive playing career behind him. He won obviously the Champions League with Dortmund, but when you look at Blackburn, when you look at Wolves, could argue even the back end of his time with Villa, it's very dour defensive football. Now, Stoke have the worst defensive record in the Premier League as it stands right now. I want to say it's 50 goals actually after tonight. I think it could be. But their defence is certainly an issue. At the same time, stating the obvious, as is often the case with promoted teams, they haven't looked as efficient in attack as they could be. They have the likes of Shaqiri, Choupo-Moting. They're lacking, for me, a real clinical forward. They've got Berahino, but he's been so off the radar for a long time, it's not even worth it. And Crouch is this option that just doesn't contribute enough goals. He's a threat, but he's not a goal scorer. And the same really applies to Diouf. I mean, he had a good chance tonight that he squandered. And I think that's the problem, is that they're now potentially looking for, I would say, not just a striker, but there's a fair shout for them to need a left back. I think the right back they've signed looks okay. He doesn't look a poor player. There's maybe even a call for someone in central midfield there as well, because I think Darren Fletcher is starting to show his age a bit. That's a lot to get done in what is, I would say, under 3 weeks now we've got. Little over 2 weeks, give or take, sorry. That's a lot to get done, especially if it's a new manager coming in and you need that player to fit into his style. It's difficult.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, but I think a lot of fans feel a little underwhelmed by him as an appointment. And again, it seems like a publicly mismanaged situation, and sort of very ill-judged at best. But hey, that seems to be Stoke right now, and a number of other teams. Let's also talk about some of those other teams later on in the podcast, though. As right now, I think it's time to talk, Chris, about Liverpool's impressive performance the other day against Man City. I think Jurgen Klopp was very pleased afterwards. He thought to himself, fucking hell. And then he said similar on American TV. Liverpool on their day, incredible. And more recently have been able to play, so it looks as if it is always their day. And I've got to admit, I've been very impressed with the performances, especially considering that this was the first big game where Coutinho was a clear absence from the starting 11. Obviously, the FA Cup last week was very different against Everton, battled out, and maybe Coutinho wouldn't have played in that anyway because of an injury. But this week, we see a big result for Liverpool, for 4-3 in the end, and obviously there are some weaknesses in there as we see Man City come back late. But, you know, apart from that, looking at the structure that Klopp has built here, I was saying this today in the office, it's hard not to see one player that hasn't notably improved under Jurgen Klopp or thrived in this system, apart from obviously Dejan Lovren, who is, even then you could still make an argument that he's improved considering his form under Rodgers.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is a lot of the traits or elements of his time at Dortmund coming to the fore. I mean, he spent 7 years at Dortmund, a similar period of time at Mainz as well. And with Dortmund more specifically, it wasn't about being able to shop at the top table, because they couldn't. They couldn't compete financially. So you look at, say, the turnaround of selling Nuri Sahin and then buying Ilkay Gundogan for, I think it was 5 million from Nuremberg. Yeah. there's an element of him which is very prevalent, that he develops players and he gets very invested in who they are. I read something recently that said that he was quite annoyed at one of his coaches for not knowing that Andy Robertson was about to become a father. And I think because he becomes so invested in who these people are, they then seek to reward that through being wholly committed to his ideas and his philosophy. And you look at someone like Oxlade-Chamberlain, for example, there were a lot of raised eyebrows at 35 million, self included, to be fair. And while he hasn't shown consistency yet, I think he showed his potential against Manchester City, whereas his other offers during that period, for my mind, were, I think Chelsea wanted him, obviously, but they were going to play him as a wing-back, whereas yeah. Liverpool brought him in and have said, look, we're going to play you as a central midfielder, which is kind of what he's always wanted to be. And where he was best, I would argue, with Southampton way back in the day. So you look at situations like that, you look at then also the sale of Coutinho, which does feel slightly reminiscent of those big money sales that Dortmund had to sort of accept as part of the consequence of where they were in football's financial food chain. To me, it just seems as if he's building a slightly similar scenario with Liverpool in terms of being willing to sell a Coutinho, knowing that, granted, Keita is a lot more than he ever spent at Dortmund, but it's that similar kind of, we'll sell Coutinho to buy Keita and Virgil van Dijk. So, yeah, to me, it's very million, interesting.
48 million is now a very average amount of money to spend in the market, considering. So, is 40 million the new 20 or 30, you know, it's definitely an interesting market, but I'm not saying Liverpool haven't spent masses of money more recently. Of course, they've spent a lot of money on Virgil van Dijk and all those other players. But I also agree, Chris, and I think Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, interestingly now, is almost notably, actually very visibly, concerned when he misplaces a pass out on the pitch. And obviously, he always wanted to make that up at Arsenal, but people are now saying, could he have ever put this performance in at Arsenal in the first place? And obviously, it was very impressive from Liverpool. It was also that I think Klopp put players in exactly the right position to do exactly what they needed to do. And that was most notably attacking the, if you're going from Liverpool's side, the sort of left inside channel. So sort of the John Stones side, if you like. Salah scored. Mane scored from there. And then obviously, Oxlade-Chamberlain and Salah's other goal were incredible strikes. It certainly is interesting, though, to see that these teams are working out different ways to attack Man City. And it's as if Jurgen Klopp put that puzzle together from previous managers. Although you would also say, Chris, even before anyone else was sort of putting this puzzle together, if Mane hadn't gone through and put his boot into the side of Edison's head originally, we might have seen a different result, or maybe something that looked a bit closer the last time they played.
Yeah, I think that's one of the interesting things about Liverpool, is that their performances do fluctuate a little bit in terms of, they are very susceptible to conceding goals, which I think they showed in the final period of the game with the last two that City scored. And yet at the same time, they will also have, say, a 15-20 minute period where they'll create some fantastic chances and convert, I would say, a decent number of them. You look at just how quickly they got the second, then the third, then the fourth. And it almost felt as if, you know, Man City were a little bit punch drunk. I think certainly they didn't handle the situation very well when they went behind. And I think part of that was because they aren't used to going behind. As I tweeted out yesterday, they've only been behind four times this season in the Premier League, and for a total of less than 90 minutes. So it's not a position they're used to being in. And I think there's something about Liverpool, or more specifically Anfield, that helps Liverpool facilitate that kind of situation when they score a goal, because the supporters get behind it. There's a change in the atmosphere almost. And it just seems to constrict the players on the opposition team a little bit more, and they seem a little bit nervous. Their touch doesn't seem as sure-footed, and they don't seem to adjust to the pace shift either. They seem to think that it's still going in gear two, when maybe it shifted up to gear three. And that's what struck me about Liverpool, was that they just handled that period so much better. There was part of me that thought, actually, hang on, you know, maybe you need 5 minutes to calm down here. But actually, that's the worst thing Liverpool could have done. What they needed to do was exactly what they did, which was go at City again, put them under more pressure, let them almost make their own mistakes, which I think is what happened, obviously, with the Salah goal with Edison. And I think that's what makes Liverpool an interesting proposition for the Champions League when that picks up next month, and possibly makes them an interesting proposition for the Premier League title in the long run. But I think the thing for them now is about almost mastering that position and mastering that situation so that they can eventually get the best of it, and so that it doesn't feel as sort of uncontrolled as I think it does now. It's something where, again, when they're on top, they seem completely fine. But I think we all saw how nerve-wracking that last little sort of period was for them when City scored a second and a third.
Speaking of uncontrolled situations, there's definitely a panic at Arsenal right now, Chris. As Alexis Sanchez definitely seems to be on his way. They seem to think that Ozil might stay. Alexis Sanchez seems to be on his way to, well, where? Manchester United, Man City have apparently pulled out of the race. Basically because, because Alexis Sanchez may have asked for too much, or Arsenal are now trying to price other clubs out. It does seem somewhat as if through other clubs coming in very late for Alexis Sanchez, it has driven the price up. If United don't get him in the end, you would say it would be good for good for Mourinho, because he will have stopped maybe Pep Guardiola getting another piece in his puzzle. But if United don't go for him and Chelsea do get him, it might not be as good for United, considering. I mean, Mourinho sounded very late back when he spoke about it this evening after the Stoke game. He said, if we get him, good for us. If someone else get him, good for them. He sounds super laid back about it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I think he should be. This is if the one thing that struck me is if Alexis Sanchez was to go to Man City, I don't think they see a huge drastic improvement. I think maybe 12 hours ago I would have said Manchester United, excuse me. But Martial has showed his potential once again. I think he's in an awkward stage that the pessimist says he's being wasted, the optimist says he's being developed. Whereas for Chelsea, again, it's that similar position of he probably fits in quite well in that attacking three up top with him, Hazard and Morata. But then you have to drop Pedro. And I think Pedro has been one of the better players for Chelsea this season. And it's almost the position, I think, that Sanchez, whether intentionally or otherwise, has managed to find himself in, whereby, yes, he's a fantastic player. Nobody will contest that. He's a very good footballer. And I think theoretically he would improve any team that he joined. The problem is I don't think any of the teams involved are desperately yearning for him. I think they would all survive and improve without him as well, and that's the that he finds himself in. As I said yesterday, you can go back and forth on whether he's doing it for money or trophies or whatever, and take whichever conclusion confirms your bias towards your team.
Good point. Well, I suppose until you see him holding the shirt, it's not really going to make much difference to your team, really, is it? It doesn't really change anything.
Well, the one thing that to me seems completely constant throughout is that he is desperate to leave Arsenal. That, right, to me is the good bigger point. Takeaway.
He'll even talk to the
devil. Yeah, it's almost irrelevant where he goes at this point, because if it's Chelsea, Man City, Man United, whatever,
he's leaving Arsenal. That's the only thing that stays the same regardless. And I think to me, that is the bigger takeaway from this, is that for him, he doesn't want to spend another 4 or 5 months at Arsenal, no matter what could happen. They could finish fourth. They could win the Europa League, let's not forget. So they've got things to potentially win as well. And yet for him, he thinks, you know what, I'd rather go to, let's say, City and pick up a medal that I haven't really earned, or go to United and try and see if we can win the Champions League, although I don't know if they're favourites personally. In the same way that, yeah, or go to Chelsea and be in a slightly similar position.
If you were Liverpool, you would just make a bid of 40 million in a pound, wouldn't you? Just for kicks.
I don't, again, it's one of those situations where I don't know if he fits in there well. That's the problem, is that I think if you're going to sign Sanchez as one of these teams, you're also going to have to change him, because for the last few seasons, he's been at a football club where usually he's been carrying the piano while playing it. He's been doing everything in that final third. And granted, Ozil has taken some of the work from him at times and been the supply line as well. But there are large portions where it's Sanchez. I look at the game against Cologne earlier in the season, where he has to sort of initiate and instigate this turnaround or this turn in fortunes.
Yeah, the pressing forward and those sorts of things.
I think part of that is he played as a central number nine. I don't think he fits as a central number nine for any of these teams. And I think what they would do, or what they would be forced to do rather, is to take him to one side and say, look, you're going to have to play a slightly more reduced role. This 25 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever you do of just dominating a game and being in every facet of it is great, but we need you for 90 minutes, not 25. And in the same way, there's a point, I would argue, where that kind of player becomes just as much of a hindrance as a help, because they're almost trying to force a situation. And I think, yeah, you need to almost reprogram Alexis Sanchez once you get him from Arsenal, because he's been used to doing so much for a team that's quite poor across the board.
Let's talk about his possible replacements as well. Apparently, Arsenal are confident of signing Aubameyang, considering it's not going great for him at Dortmund right now. Maybe he's had some, and maybe you don't want to replace Alexis Sanchez with someone else who comes with maybe some emotional baggage. I'm not saying Sanchez has got incredible amounts of baggage, but apparently he doesn't need an arm around him. And then there's Aubameyang, who, you know, has missed training, those sorts of things. Do you want to, you know, if Wenger is transitioning away, do you want to take a chance on a player like that, considering he is an incredible talent? Or do you also want to look at the likes of Malcolm, Chris? I mean, there's two incredible young players there. Malcolm much younger, obviously, than Aubameyang, but still, you know, relatively fresh, and Wenger is about to go into a peak period. Do you think either of those players are viable for Arsenal?
I mean, reports say that Arsenal are confident of getting them, which, you know, that's an interesting statement of intent if they do get both. I think what they point to is the fact that Arsene Wenger is slowly transitioning away from the club, if anything. Because to me, these deals have the hallmark of the new sporting director, formerly of Dortmund, Sven Mislintat. Is it Mislintat, I think it's pronounced?
I think that's how you say it.
It's close enough. It's the Pro Evo version, let's argue. I think that, yeah, to me, those two deals strike of him, because there was talk, actually, that he wanted Malcolm when he was at Dortmund. So I think it's something to certainly be pleased of and excited of. I think from Aubameyang's perspective, it points to a player that perhaps has missed his opportunity to move to a truly huge club, because there was talk of him only ever wanting to play for Real Madrid to keep a promise to his father. Now that's a significant step down with Arsenal. It's a huge upgrade for them, undeniably. He gives them pace, he gives them goals, a lot of things that they've kind of missed, that real target forward. Now,
but like I said, at the same time, signed for that.
Well, that's it? Yeah, that's just what I was coming on to, is that at the same time, Lacazette was seen as that player. And said when he joined, you know, I think Arsenal play the best football, etc., etc., as you might expect a new signing to do. Yeah. But he hasn't had the impact that you would expect. And I think it points to the fact that really Arsenal need the dreaded overhaul. There are a number of players that that aren't fit for purpose. Petr Cech is I think rapidly on the decline. Mertesacker is months from retiring. Holding isn't ready yet. Mustafi has the quality, I think.
Do you think there was a problem on the weekend as well? That, I mean, this side, they definitely have some personnel that can beat the likes of, you know, a Bournemouth in there, but they just did not put that into practice at all.
Yeah, I think that's the problem, is that I look at someone like Xhaka in the middle of midfield and I just don't know what he does, to be quite frank. It's a shame we don't have Dave, because I'd be curious to hear his opinion, or Nico for that matter.
Having known from the live show the other day, I don't think that either of their central midfielders had a particularly impressive game.
Yeah, I think that's the problem, is that Xhaka is a defensive midfielder that doesn't really defend. I've done pieces on this in the past that looked at the more intangible aspect of his game, that he doesn't bring leadership or anything. And you think back to that story about the house keys when he was a kid that kind of was lampooned quite quickly. He's been given the keys to Arsenal's midfield and it's turned out terribly because, like I say, bar some long balls, I don't see what he's giving. And it makes me question if actually he was a player that had his skills exemplified by the fact that he played in a team that perhaps counter-attack more than Arsenal do. I don't know if that's part of their ethos. And when he's given a situation where he has to play through the lines, his passing is so wildly inconsistent. Even with the surge in prices that we've seen these last few years, where at one stage Pogba looked crazy for 90 million, now it looks very much par for the course. 35 million for Granit Xhaka to me still looks overpriced, and that's the most damning criticism I can give of him.
Yeah, certainly it's a criticism as well. Well, I'm sure that there's actually some really interesting headlines coming out tonight about whether Chelsea will even be able to financially compete for Sanchez at this point. Apparently, there is an issue with the fact that Chelsea. There's a bit of an FFP issue there. I think there's a financial issue at the club anyway, and whether they will actually be able to compete for him, I hear, is in contention tonight with mainly Manchester United only as the club competing for a signature. Essentially, they're not competing against anyone if it's just them. Now, Chris, obviously, as the day that we record this, there's quite some sad stories coming out as well. One being Cyril Regis passed away, who was a player I think many regard as a hero in English football, considering the times that he played in. He played through immense racism, just really harsh conditions for him to play in terms of the treatment that he received, and also the time that he played in, and you know, the fact that when he became an England player, he was sent a bullet in the post. You know, out on the pitch, he was susceptible to very little in terms of tackles or physicality. Apparently, he was a fantastic player out on the pitch to play against. And there are quite a few people who've said what a difficult adversary he was, because I think it was Alan Hansen said you just couldn't tackle him because he was so strong, but at the same time so fast. I don't know, there's something about him inspiring a generation of players. And I think even now, when you look at modern day players, you can see elements of Cyril Regis in their DNA. And I don't feel like that's hyperbole.
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, Johan Cruyff wanted him at Ajax in, I think it was 87. But for some dallying by the board, he would have got the player he wanted. But ultimately, Regis's price rose to the point where Ajax couldn't compete and couldn't afford him. So, yeah, I think that's not hyperbole at all. I think that the situation with his legacy is something that we need to celebrate in certain quarters. I think we need to accept it and almost take responsibility for it in others, because the struggle and the situation that he was put through is shameful. I think it would have been shameful if it was 100 years ago, never mind 10 or 20. I think, excuse me, I forget sometimes how quickly time passes. And yeah, I think that
like I say, we have to celebrate the man that handled that with such dignity and class. And yet, at the same time, we have to take responsibility. And more importantly, the FA has to take responsibility to point to the fact that this needs to be a situation that is learned from in every sense. Who is that next generation? Who, unfortunately, is dealing with a similar, if also different, kind of racial abuse? That shouldn't be the case anymore. We have to reach a stage as a community, as a fraternity, whichever word you want to use, where we look at the stories of Cyril Regis and almost can't believe they're true. That has to be our end goal. And unfortunately, at this precise moment, as he passes, very sadly, it doesn't feel as if we've made a huge development. And I think that's now what we have to take as our objective moving into 2018 as we sadly lay him to rest.
And exactly. I think it is a very sad day for football. I think for a lot of people in England also acknowledging that, you know, especially considering how young he was, I think 59, obviously, but that generation of footballers beginning to pass away, and there's something quite sad about losing that time in football as well, I think, in terms of the fact that someone like a hero such as him could rise to the top despite everything that was against him. There's an incredibly inspirational story there, and one that you should definitely look up. There's a lot of great highlights online of his incredible goals. Go and take a look. I will try and tweet some out of the TF3 account. Now, Chris, let's finish on some interesting news for Wales tonight. As Ryan Giggs sought the advice of Sir Alex Ferguson, and then earlier today, that's Monday, was appointed Wales manager. It's big. Gareth Bale could be in with a real captaincy here, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, look, Ryan Giggs is a very talented player, and I have seen people debate with me on Twitter that Mark Hughes walked into a slightly similar situation, in the sense that he didn't have a huge amount of experience. I don't think you should make the exception the rule. That's my concern.
Right.
I think you look at Chris Coleman, who did an apprenticeship with Fulham and Real Sociedad. Gary Speed was at Sheffield United for a time. And the fact that Craig Bellamy interviewed very well in this, apparently, I think makes it a slightly worse situation. Because for me, Giggs' legend is not with Wales, it's with Man United. He famously actually dropped out of a number of friendly squads, didn't show up, had little niggling injuries in inverted commas that were said to be non-existent in actual fact. And I think that's the concern, is that yes, it's a start for him, and you could say, well, he's been rewarded for being patient and not jumping at a job lower down the leagues where it might have been more of a struggle. But I even think you look at that top five in the Premier League, Pep Guardiola, Jurgen Klopp, even Jose Mourinho spent time as an assistant at Benfica before getting that job very briefly and then went back down the leagues and worked his way up to get back to Porto and springboard his career. Same with Pochettino. Again, started at a team that was struggling a bit. And I think you learn more from that. You know, I think it is an old trope in football that you learn more from defeat than victory. And I think the same applies to learning with teams where you aren't blessed with everything, where you have to find inventive ways to sort of circumnavigate the struggles. I'm a little bit disappointed, I have to confess. I mean, I'm not a Wales fan, so I don't have any personal investment in it. But I don't think it's the best appointment. I think it's a needless risk to take, because ultimately it will come down to how he performs in tournament football, I think, that will do him. And I actually don't even think that's the greatest precursor to a time in club career in club management anyway, to be honest.
Well, let's see. I still think they should give it Giggs till the end of the season, like I said. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us tonight. I know it was a slightly shorter podcast. We are TF2 rather than TF3, but we will make up for it later in the week when we have a full complement of people, players, staff, etc. If you want to get in contact with us, you can at us at the front three. You can also at Chris, which is at khenage, khenage. All of that is in the description for the podcast. Chris, can people go read anything of yours this week?
Yes, I did something on Jamal Lascelles as an outside bet for England. I also wrote about Carlos Tevez's 40 million heist of Chinese football that, having gone up today, is now arguably a millisecond out of date, because he has since admitted that he pretty much just went for the money in the second he stepped off the plane, he knew he wanted to go home.
Yeah, he brought quite the entourage with him as well, I've heard. I think World Football Phone-In is quite insightful about Carlos Tevez and his exploits out in many different countries. A very, very interesting guy in the first place. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us tonight. It's been good to have you. Of course, speak to you online, and you are quite engaged on Twitter.
Yeah, I'd love to hear what people have to say, even idiots.
That's true. Mark Goldbridge was tweeting just the other night, though through which account we don't know. I think that's a very niche reference, but if you're into football Twitter, then you're going to know what I mean. And it made me laugh for quite a long time today. Have you ever tweeted yourself?
Have I ever tweeted myself?
Have you ever tweeted yourself from another account that you made yourself?
No, because I didn't make my podcast account.
Good point. Very good point. I hope you guys enjoy this week. Go and look up exactly what we're talking about. If you want to find out more, you can tweet at us with the hashtag, what are you talking about? We will see you later in the week with a full complement of people. And we hope that you enjoy the football between now and then. See you later.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.